in on the way home. They knew I wrote the titles on the napkin. My eyes read it. Just a few words, in red. Dear Ed, good work. But don't worry, it's simpler than you think. I go back and sit with the books. I read Barren Woman until I know it word for word. The doorman wants a walk later, so we go. We meander through the streets of town, and I try to guess where the next addresses will be. Any clues, doorman? I ask. There's no reply. He's far too busy carrying out his casual, investigative style of sniffing. What I haven't recognized till now is that the answers are signposted. They're everywhere, at the top of every street and at every intersection. What if the messages are hidden in the titles, I wonder? The book titles. All I'd have to do is match the street to one of each writer's books. Simpler than you think, I tell myself. The napkin's still in my pocket, along with the Ace of Spades. I pull both out and look at them. The names watch me, and I swear they see it when I understand. I lean down a moment and speak excitedly to the doorman. Come on, I say. We have to get moving. We run home. Or at least we go as fast as the doorman will allow. I need the books, the street directory, and hopefully a few minutes. Yes, we run. Each book waits and I sit there with my old Gregory street directory, trying to find a match with any of the titles. I go through Graham Greene first again. There's no Human Street, no Factor Street, no Heart Street. After a minute or so, I find it. I hold the book in my hand. It's black, and the title's written in gold on the spine. The Power and the Glory. There's no Power Street, but my eyes grow large with realization when I go back a few pages. The name greets my eyes like a fist. Glory Road. I grin and ruffle up the doorman's fur. Glory Road. That's bloody brilliant. I'd love to live on Glory Road. On the map, it's way up on the edge of town. Now I go through the Morris West titles. It's faster this time. The Clowns of God. I find a clown street in the upper part of town. Last of all, Sylvia's one is Bell Street, from the Bell Jar. According to the directory, Bell Street is one of the small side streets off the main street of town. Now I check that none of the other titles also match. But I'm safe. They're the ones. Just one question for each street. What number? Now I have to dig. This is Spades, so I have to dig. The clues must be in the books, so now I shove the other ones to the side and focus on the three finalists. I feel kind of sorry for the ditched ones, to be honest. They look like the losers of a dramatic, tumultuous race, sitting on the floor. If they were people, they'd each have their head in their hands. First, I reach for the Power and the Glory. I read well into the night, and it's 1 o'clock before I look up from the pages. I have no clues yet, and I can feel frustration starting to creep in. What if I've missed it? I wonder, but I'm certain I'll know it when I see it. For all I know, the numbers on Glory Road might only go up to 20 or 30, but I read on. I feel I must. This is what it's all about. Quitting now would be a sin. At 3:46 a.m., it's burned into my memory, I find it. Page 114. At the bottom of the page, in the left corner, there's the symbol for spades, drawn in black. Next to it are the words, "Nicely done, Ed." I collapse back onto the couch in triumph. It doesn't get much better than this. No stones, no violence. It's about time this all became civilized. Now I go straight to the Clowns of God and flick through. I can't believe I didn't just do this to begin with. It's definitely much easier than trying to find the clues in every word on every page. Simpler than you think, I remind myself. This time it's on page 23. Just the symbol. And in the Bell Jar, it's page 39. I have the addresses, and I have exhaustion. The digging's over. I sleep. Four of Spades. The Benefits of Lying. It's Tuesday evening and we're playing cards at my place. Richie's complaining of a sore collarbone from the sledge game, Audrey's enjoying herself, and Marv's winning. He's unbearable, as usual. I've been to Glory Road, and I've seen number 114. It's a Polynesian family, with a husband bigger than the guy from Edgar Street. He works in construction and treats his wife like a queen and his kids like gods. When he gets home from work, he picks them up and throws them in the air. They laugh and carry on and look forward to him arriving. Glory Road is long and isolated. The houses are all pretty old. Or fibro. I don't know what to do there yet, but I'm pretty confident by now. It'll come to me.
Looks like I win again, gloats Marv.
He's in good form, with a cigar jammed into the side of his mouth.
Oh, I hate you, Marv, says Richie.
He's only summing up what we're all thinking at times like this. Marv's quick to organise a Christmas game.
Whose turn is it this year?
He asks, though we all know it's his and he'll try to get out of it. Marv could never cook a Christmas dinner. Not because he's hopeless. He's just too tight. He wouldn't pay for a turkey to save his life. Breakfast on the day of the sledge game was a oncer.
You, Richie points straight at Marv. It's your turn, Marv.
You sure about that?
Yes, Richie's emphatic.
I am.
But you know, my folks will be there, and my sister and...
Stiff shit, Marv, we love your parents.
Richie's in fine touch. We all know he couldn't care less where the party's on. He's just loving getting stuck into Marv.
And we love your sister, too. She's hot as summer sand, boy. She's raging.
Summer sand? Audrey asks. Raging? Richie slams his fist on the table.
Damn right, girl.
The three of us laugh as Marv fidgets. It isn't like you don't have the money, I say. 30 grand, isn't it?
Just hit 40,
he replies. This triggers a discussion of what Marv intends to do with that kind of money. He tells us it's his business alone and we don't give it a lot more thought. I guess we don't give many things a lot of thought. After a few more minutes, I relent. We'll just have it here, I say. I look over at Marv. But you'll have to put up with the doorman, mate. Marv isn't happy, but he agrees. I go for more. All right, Marv, I say. I'll tell you what. I'll have the Christmas game right here under one condition.
What?
You have to bring the doorman a present. I can't help rubbing it in a little. With Marv, you have to get mileage, and I must say this is turning out better than I'd hoped. I'm delighted with myself. You can bring him a nice juicy steak, and, this is where it gets even better, you have to give him a big Christmas kiss. Richie clicks his fingers.
Brilliant idea, Ed. Perfect.
Marv stunned.
Outraged. That's disgraceful,
he tells me, but still it's better than paying for a turkey and going to the effort of cooking. He finally makes up his mind.
All right, I'll do it.
He points a finger at me now. But you're one twisted bastard, Ed.
Thanks, Marv. I appreciate it. And for the first time in many years, I find myself looking forward to Christmas.
Depending on my cab shifts, I continue going back to Glory Road, and though it's obvious this family is working hard to make ends meet, I still don't know what I have to do. One evening, when I'm standing behind the bushes, the father comes over to me. He's a very big boy and could strangle me with one hand behind his back. He doesn't look happy.
Hey, he calls out. You there. I seen you before.
He moves fast toward me.
Get out of those bushes quick, smart.
His voice isn't loud. It sounds like it would be gentle and quiet in most situations. It's the size of him that concerns me. Don't worry, I calm myself. You need to be here. It'll take what it takes. I step out and face the man as the sun sets behind the house. He has smooth dark skin and black curly hair and eyes that threaten me.
You been spying on my kids, boy?
No, sir, I lift my head. I need to look proud and honest. Hang on, I remind myself. I am honest. Well, pretty much.
Well, why are you here?
I lie and hope. I used to live in this house, I say.
Shit, good thinking, Ed.
I've actually impressed myself. A lot of years ago, before we moved closer to town. Sometimes I like to come up here and look at the place. And please, I beg, let these people not have lived here long. My dad died not long ago, and when I come here, I think of him. I think of him when I see you with your kids, throwing them in the air and over your shoulder. The man softens slightly.
Thank you, God.
He comes a little closer as the sun falls on its hands and knees behind him.
Yeah, it's a pretty shoddy old place,
he motions with his hand, but it's the best we can do right now. It looks all right to me, I say. We go on a while longer, and in the end, the man asks me a surprising question. He moves back, thinks, then says,
Hey,
Would you like to come in and look around? We're about to have dinner. You're welcome to stay.
My gut instinct is to decline, but I don't. The harder decision is to go in. I follow the man onto his front porch and into the house. Before we go in, he says,
"My name's Lua. Lua Tutupu."
"Ed Kennedy," I respond, and we shake hands. Lua crushes nearly every bone in my right hand.
"Marie," he calls out when we're inside.
"Kids?" He turns to me.
"The place just like you remember it?"
"Sorry?" Then I remember. "Oh, yeah, it is." The kids come pouring out of the woodwork and start climbing all over us. Lua introduces me to them and to his wife. Dinner is mashed potatoes and frankfurts. We eat, and Lua tells jokes and the kids laugh and laugh, even though they've heard the same jokes 1,000 times, according to Marie. Marie has wrinkles under her eyes and looks worn down from life and kids and putting food on the table each night. She's got milder skin than Lua and dark brown wavy hair. She was beautiful once, even more beautiful than this. She works in one of the supermarkets. There are 5 kids. All have trouble eating with their mouths closed, but when they laugh, you can see the world in their eyes. You can tell exactly why Lua treats them like he does and loves them that much.
"Can I have a piggyback from Ed, Dad?"
one of the girls asks. I nod to him, and Lua says,
"Of course, darling, but you have to put something else in that sentence."
It reminds me of Father O'Reilly's brother, Tony. The girl smacks herself on the forehead, smiling and saying,
"Can he please give me a piggyback?"
"Sure, baby," Lua says, and I do. I've given 13 piggybacks by the time Marie rescues me from the youngest of the boys.
"Jesse, I think Ed's all tuckered out, okay?"
"Okay," Jesse gives in, and I fall backward to the couch. Jesse's about 6, and while I'm sitting there, he whispers something in my ear. It's the answer. He says,
"My dad's putting up our Christmas lights soon. You have to come back and have a look one day. I love those lights."
"I promise," I say. "I'll come." I look around the house one last time, almost convincing myself that I used to live here. I even conjure up a whole lot of great memories with my dad inside these walls. Lou is asleep when I leave, so it's Marie who sees me out. "Thank you," I say, "for everything." She only looks at me with her warm, genuine eyes and says,
"No worries, Ed. Come back any time."
"I will," I say. This time, I'm not lying. On the weekend, I go past during the day. The Christmas lights are up and they're very old and faded. Some of the lights are missing. They're the old-style lights. They're not the type to flash. They're just big bulbs in different colours strung along the eaves above the front porch. I'll come back later, I think, to have a look. Sure enough, in the evening when the lights are on, I see that only half the ones that are still there actually work. That translates to 4 globes in operation. 4 globes to brighten up the Tutupu house this year. It's not a big thing, but I guess it's true. Big things are often just small things that are noticed. The first chance I get, I'll be back during the day when everyone's at school and work. Something has to be done about those lights. I go to Kmart and buy a brand new set of lights, exactly the same as the existing ones. Nice big globes of red and blue and yellow and green. It's a hot Wednesday, and surprisingly, there are no questions from the neighbors as I get on the Tutupu's front porch and stand on a large overturned pot. I dismantle the original lights, bending back the nails that hold the power cord. When the whole thing is down, I notice the plug goes inside, as I should have expected, so I can't do the job completely. Instead, I put the old lights back up and leave the new ones at the front door. I don't leave a note. There's nothing else to do. At first, I wanted to write "Merry Christmas" on the box somewhere, but I decide against it. This isn't about words. It's about glowing lights and small things that are big. 5 of Spades, The Power and the Glory. I'm eating ravioli in the kitchen that same night when a van pulls up in front of the shack. The engine growls to a halt, and I hear the car doors slam. Next, I hear the sound of little fists on my front door. The doorman barks for a change, but I calm him down and open up. Standing there are Lua, Marie, and every kid from that family.
"Hi, Ed," says Lua, and the rest of them echo him.
He continues, "We looked you up in the local phone book, but you weren't in it.
so we rang all the other Kennedys around here. Your mother gave us the address.
There's quiet now as I wonder what Ma might have told them.
Marie breaks it. Come with us, she says.
Riding in the van, squashed between all the kids, I sit there, and for the first time with this family, everyone's quiet. This, as you can imagine, makes me considerably uneasy. The street lamps flick past like pages of light, each coming toward me and then turning away. Closing. When I look forward, I catch Lua looking at me in the rearview mirror. We arrive at the house within 5 or 10 minutes. Marie takes charge.
Right. Inside, kids.
She goes with them, and this leaves Lua and me in the van together. Again, he looks in the mirror and lets his eyes reflect backward to mine.
Ready? He asks.
For what?
He only shakes his head.
Don't give me that, Ed. He gets out and rams the door shut.
Well, come on, he calls in through the window. Get out, boy.
Boy. I didn't like the way he said that. Kind of foreboding. My big fear is that I've insulted him with the new lights. He might be taking it as a sign that he can't provide properly for his own family. He might think I'm saying, this poor inadequate fool can't even get a full set of lights to work properly. I don't dare to look at the house as I follow him to where he stands at the edge of the road, looking back. It's dark there. Very dark. We stand. Lua watches me. I watch the ground. The next thing I hear is the sound of the fly screen door opening and slamming several times. The kids come sprinting toward us, followed by Marie at a fast walk. When I count the kids, I realize one of them's missing. Jessie. I search all the faces before looking again at the ground. The loud call of Lua's voice almost makes me jump.
Okay, Jess, he shouts.
A few seconds collect and fall, and when I look up, the old Fibro house is lit up. The lights are so beautiful that they appear almost to hold the house up by themselves. The faces of the kids, Lua and Marie, are splashed with red, blue, yellow and green. I can feel a red light shining over my own face and my own relieved smile. The kids are cheering and clapping and saying this will be the best Christmas ever. The girls start dancing together, holding hands. That's when Jessie comes running from the house to have a look. He insisted on turning the power on, Lua tells me, and when I look at him, Jessie's smile is the biggest and the best. The most alive. This is his moment, I think, and Lua and Marie's. When we got those new lights, Jessie said he wanted you to be here when we turned them on. So what else could we do? I shake my head, looking into the colours shining across the yard. They swim through my eyes. To myself I say, the power and the glory. 6 of Spades, a moment of beauty. As the kids dance around the front yard under the night sky and the lights, I see something. Lua and Marie are holding hands. They look like they're so happy, just inside this moment, watching the kids and the lights in their old Fibro house. Lua kisses her, just softly on the lips, and she kisses back. Sometimes people are beautiful. Not in looks, not in what they say, just in what they are. 7 of Spades, a moment of truth. Marie makes me come in for a cup of coffee. At first I knock it back, but she insists.
You have to, Ed.
I give in, and we go inside and drink and talk. It's all comfortable for quite a while, until Marie's words stop and stand in the middle of the conversation. She stirs her coffee and says,
Thank you, Ed.
The wrinkles around her eyes become a little unsettled, and her eyes seem filled with sparks.
Thank you so much.
For what?
She shakes her head.
Don't make me say it, Ed. We know it was you. Jessie couldn't keep a secret if we glued his mouth shut.
We know it was you.
I surrender completely.
You deserved it.
She's still not satisfied.
But why? Why us?
That, I tell her the truth, I have no idea about. I sip the coffee. This is all very long and almost unexplainable. All I know is that I was standing outside this old house, and the rest just happened. Now Lua walks in among the words and pushes them forward. He says,
You know, Ed, we've been living here close to a year now, and nobody, absolutely nobody, has ever lifted a finger to help us or make us feel welcome.
He drinks. We expect no more these days. People have enough trouble getting by on their own.
His eyes hold on to mine for just a second.
But then you come along, out of nowhere. We just don't get it. That's when a moment of clarity takes shape in front of me.
I say, don't even try. I don't understand it myself.
Marie accepts my statement, but still takes it a little further. She says, fair enough, Ed, but we do want to thank you.
Yes, says Lua.
Marie nods to him and he stands up and walks over to the fridge. Stuck to it with a magnet is an envelope. The name Ed Kennedy is on it, and he comes back and hands it to me.
We don't have much, he says, but this is the best we can do to thank you.
He places it in my hands.
Somehow, I think you'll like it. Just a feeling.
Inside is a homemade Christmas card. All the kids have drawn on it. Christmas trees, bright lights, and kids playing. Some of the drawings are shockers, but still excellent. Inside are the words, also written by one of the kids. Dear Ed, have a happy Christmas. We hope you also have some beautiful lights like the ones you gave us. From all the Tutupu family. It makes me smile and I stand up and go into the lounge room where the kids are all sprawled out watching the telly.
Hey, thanks for the card, I say to them.
They all answer me, but it's Jesse who speaks loudest.
It's the least we could do, Ed.
And within a few seconds, they're all focused on the TV again. It's a video. One of those animal adventure things. They're all glued to a cat going down a stream in a cardboard box.
See you all later, I say, but none of them hears.
I only look contentedly at the pictures again and head back to the kitchen. When I get there, the presentation isn't over. Lou is standing there with a small dark stone that has a pattern on it like a cross. He says, a friend once gave this to me, Ed. It's for luck. He holds it out to me. I want you to have it. At first, we all look down at it, not speaking. My voice takes me by surprise.
No,
I say. I can't take it, Lua. His quiet, gentle words are calm but urgent. His eyes are wild with sincerity.
No, Ed. You have to. You've given us so much.
More than you'll ever know. He holds out the stone again and goes to the extent of putting it in my palm and closing my hand to hold it firmly. He holds my hand in both of his.
It's yours.
Not only for luck, Marie tells me, also for remembering. Now I accept the stone and look at it.
Thank you, I say to both of them. I'll look after it.
Lua places his hand on my shoulder.
I know.
The three of us stand in the kitchen, together. When I leave, Marie kisses me on the cheek and we say goodbye.
Remember, she says, come back any time. You're always welcome here.
Thank you, I reply, and head out the front door. Lua wants to drive me home, but I refuse, mainly because I really do feel like walking tonight. We shake hands, Lua crushing me once again. He walks me out to the edge of the front lawn and wants an answer to one final question.
Let me ask you something, Ed.
We're a few steps apart.
Of course.
He moves a little further away as we stand in the dark. Behind us, the lights still glow proudly in the night. This is the moment of truth.
Lua says, you never lived in our house, Ed, did you?
There's no hiding it now. No way out.
No, I answer. I didn't.
We observe each other, and I can see there are many things that Lua wants to know. He's about to ask when I see him pull back. He prefers not to ruin things with any more questions.
What it is what it is.
Bye, Ed.
Goodbye, Lua.
We shake hands and walk in our different directions. At the end of the road, just before I go around the corner, I turn one last time to see the lights. Eight of Spades. Clown Street, Chips, the doorman, and me. It's the hottest day of the year, and I've got a day shift in the city. The cab has air conditioning, but it breaks down, much to the disgust of everyone I pick up. I warn them every time they get in, but only one gets back out. It's a man who still has his last lungful of a Winfield in his mouth.
Bloody hopeless, he tells me.
I know. I only shrug and agree. The stone that Lua Tutupu gave me is in my left pocket. It makes me happy in the festering city traffic, even when the lights are green and all the cars remain still. Not long after I return the cab to base, Audrey pulls into the lot.
She winds her window down to talk to me.
Sweating like crazy in here, she says. I imagine the sweat on her and how I'd like to taste it. With blank expression, I slide down into the visual details.
Head?
Her hair's greasy but great. Lovely blonde, like hay. I see the three or four spots of sun thrown across her face. Again, she speaks.
Head?
Sorry, I say. I was thinking of something. I look back to where the boyfriend stands, expecting her. He's waiting for you. When I return to Audrey's face, I miss it and catch a glimpse of her fingers on the wheel. They're relaxed and coated with light, and they're lovely. Does he notice those small things? I wonder. But I don't speak it to Audrey. I only say, have a good night, and step back from the car.
You too, Ed.
She drives on. Even later, as the sun goes down and I walk into town and onto Clown Street, I see all of Audrey. I see her arms and bony legs. I see her smiling as she talks and eats with the boyfriend. I imagine him feeding her food from his fingers in her kitchen. And she eats it, allowing enough of her lips to smudge him with her beauty. The doorman's with me, my faithful companion. Along the way, I buy us some hot chips with lots of salt and vinegar. It's old style, all wrapped in the racing section of today's newspaper. The hot tip is a 2-year-old mare called Bacon Rashes. I wonder how she went. The doorman, on the other hand, cares little. He can smell the chips. When we make it to 23 Clown Street, we discover that it's a restaurant. It's tiny, and it's called Meluso's. Italian. It's in a little shopping village and follows the small restaurant ritual of being dimly lit. It smells good. There's a park bench across the road, and we sit there, eating the chips. My hand reaches down inside the package, through the sweaty, greasy paper. I love every minute of it. Each time I throw the doorman a chip, he lets it hit the ground, leans over it, and licks it up. He turns nothing down, this dog. I don't think he cares too much about his cholesterol. Nothing tonight. Or the next. In fact, time is wasting away. It's a tradition now. Clown Street, chips, the doorman and me. The owner is old and dignified, and I'm quite sure it isn't him I'm here to see. I can tell. Something's coming. On Friday night, after standing outside the restaurant and going home after closing, I find Audrey sitting on my porch, waiting. She's wearing board shorts and a light shirt without a bra. She isn't big up there, Audrey, but she's nice. I stop for a moment, hesitate, and continue. The doorman loves her and throws himself into a trot.
Hey, doorman, she says.
She crouches down warmly to greet him. They're good friends, those two.
Hi, Ed.
Hi, Audrey. I open the door, and she follows me in. We sit, in the kitchen.
So where were you this time?
She asks. It's almost laughable, because usually that question is asked with contempt to unreliable bastard husbands. Clown Street, I answer.
Clown Street?
I nod. Some restaurant there.
There's actually a street called Clown Street?
I know.
Anything happened there yet?
No.
I see.
As she looks away, I make my mind up. I say, so why are you here, Audrey? She looks down. Away. When she finally answers, she says,
I guess I missed you, Ed.
Her eyes are pale green and wet. I want to tell her it's barely been a week since we last got together, but I think I know what she means.
I feel like you're slipping away somehow. You've become different since all this started.
Different? I ask it, but I know it. I am. I stand up and look into her.
Yes, she confirms it. You used to just be.
She explains this like she doesn't really want to hear it. It's more a case that she has to say it.
Now you're somebody, Ed. I don't know everything about what you've done and what you've been through, but I don't know. You seem further away now.
It's ironic, don't you think? All I've ever wanted was to get closer to her. I've tried desperately. She concludes.
You're better.
It's with those words that I see things from Audrey's perspective. She liked me being just Ed. It was safer that way. Stable. Now I've changed things. I've left my own fingerprints on the world, no matter how small, and it's upset the equilibrium of us, Audrey and me. Maybe she's afraid that if I can't have her, I won't want her. Like this. Like we used to be.
She doesn't want to love me, but she doesn't want to lose me either. She wants us to stay okay, like before, but it's not as certain anymore.
We will, I try to promise. I hope I'm right.
Still in the kitchen, my fingers feel the stone from Lua in my pocket again. I think about what Audrey's been telling me. Maybe I truly am shedding the old Ed Kennedy for this new person who's full of purpose rather than incompetence. Maybe one morning I'll wake up and step outside of myself to look back at the old me lying dead among the sheets. It's a good thing, I know. But how can a good thing suddenly feel so sad? I've wanted this from the beginning. I head back to the fridge and get more to drink. I've come to the conclusion that we have to get drunk. Audrey agrees.
So what were you doing? I ask later on the couch.
Well, I was at Clown Street. I see her thoughts swivel. She's drunk enough to tell me, at least in a coy kind of way.
You know,
she embarrasses.
No, I mock her a little. I don't.
I was with Simon at my place and we... for a few hours.
A few hours?
I'm hurt, but keep it out of my voice. How'd you manage the strength to get over here?
I don't know, she admits. He went home and I felt empty.
So you came here, I think. But I'm not bitter. Not at this moment. I rationalize that none of the physical things matter so much. Audrey needs me now, and for old time's sake, that's good enough. She wakes me a bit later. We're still on the couch. A small crowd of bottles is assembled on the table. They sit there like onlookers, like observers at an accident. Audrey looks me hard in the face, wavers, then hands me a question.
Do you hate me, Ed?
Still stupid with bubbles and vodka in my stomach, I answer, very seriously.
Yes, I whisper. I do.
We both smack the sudden silence with laughter. When it returns, we hit it again. The laughter spins in front of us and we keep hitting it. When it calms completely, Audrey whispers,
I don't blame you.
The next time I'm woken, it's by a cracking at the door. I stammer there, open it, and there in front of me is the guy who jumped my cab. That feels like an eternity ago. He looks annoyed, as usual. He holds his hand up for me to be quiet and says, just...
He waits for effect.
Shut up and listen. He actually sounds a touch more than annoyed as he continues. Look, Ed. The yellow-rimmed eyes scratch me. It's 3 a.m. It's still humid as hell, and here we are. Yes, I agree. A cloud of drunkenness hangs over me. I almost expect rain. Here we are. Now don't you mock me, boy. I reel back. I'm sorry. What is it? He pauses, and the air sounds violent between us. He speaks. Tomorrow. 8 p.m. sharp. Meluso's. He walks away before remembering something. And do me a favor, will you?
Of course.
Cut down on the chips, for Christ's sake. You're making me sick. Now he points at me, threatening. Hurry up with all this shit. You might think I don't have better things to do, but as it happens, I do, all right?
All right. It's only fair.
In my stupor, I try for something extra. I call out, Who's sending you? The young man with the gold-rimmed eyes, black suit of clothes, and brutal disposition returns up the porch steps. He says,
How the hell would I know, Kennedy?
He even laughs and shakes his head.
You might not be the only one getting aces in the mail. Did you ever think of that?
He lingers a little longer, turns, and trudges off, dissolving into the darkness, blending in. Audrey's behind me at the door now, and I've got something to think about. I write down what he told me about Meluso's. 8 p.m. tomorrow night. I have to be there. After sticking the note to the fridge, I go to bed, and Audrey comes with me. She sleeps with her leg across me, and I love the feel of her breath on my throat. After perhaps 10 minutes, she says,
Tell me, Ed. Tell me about where you've been.
I've told her once before about the Ace of Diamonds messages, but not in any detail. I'm so tired now, but I do tell her. About Miller. Beautiful Miller. As I speak, I see her pleading face as she begged me that she did right by her Jimmy. About Sophie. The barefoot girl with... Audrey's asleep. She's asleep. But I go on speaking. I tell her about Edgar Street and all the others. The Stones, the Beatings, Father O'Reilly, Angie Caruso, the Rose Boys, the Tatupu family. Just for now, I find I'm happy, and I want to stay awake. But soon the night falls down, beating me hard into sleep.
9 of Spades. The Woman. The yawn of a girl can be so beautiful it makes you cringe. Especially when she's standing in your kitchen in her underpants and a shirt yawning. Audrey's doing this right now as I do the dishes. I rinse a plate and there she is, rubbing her eyes, yawning, then smiling. Sleep okay? I ask. She nods and says, You're comfortable, Ed. I realize I could take that comment badly, but it's a compliment. Have a seat, I say, and without thinking, I look at her shirt buttons and her hips. I follow her legs down to her knees, shins, and ankles. All in a brief second. Audrey's feet look soft and delicate, almost like they could melt into the kitchen floor. I make her some cereal and she crunches it. I didn't have to ask if she wanted some. Some things I know. This is confirmed later, once Audrey's had a shower and dressed fully. At the front door, she says, Thanks, Ed. She pauses before speaking again. You know, out of everyone, you know me the best, and you treat me the best. I feel most comfortable with you. She even leans close and kisses me on the cheek. Thanks for putting up with me. As she walks away, I still feel her lips on my skin, the taste of them. I watch her all the way up the street till she turns the corner. Just before she does, she knows I'm standing there, and she turns one last moment and waves. In answer, I hold up my hand, and she's gone. Slowly, at times painfully, Audrey is killing me.
And do me a favor, will you? Cut down on the chips, for Christ's sake.
I hear the words of my friend from last night again. All day they come back at me, along with the other statement he made.
You might not be the only one getting aces in the mail. Did you ever think of that?
Of course, there was a question mark at the end of his words, but I know it was a statement. It makes me think about all the people I've run into. What if they're all messengers, like me, and they're all threatened and desperate just to get through what they have to do to survive? I wonder if they, too, have received playing cards and firearms in their letterboxes, or if they've had their own specific tools provided. It would all be personal, I think. I got cards because that's what I do. Maybe Daryl and Keith were given the balaclavas, and my mate from last night was given his black outfit and his cantankerous demeanor. By 7:45, I'll be back at Meluso's, minus the doorman. This time, I'm going in. I have to explain it to him before I go. He looks at me.
What? He asks. No chips tonight?
Sorry, mate. I'll bring you back something, I promise. He seems happy enough by the time I leave, because I've fixed him a coffee and thrown some ice cream in it as well. He almost jumps from paw to paw as I'm putting it down for him.
Nice,
he tells me in the kitchen. We're still friends. I must admit, I even miss him a little as I walk to Clown Street in Meluso's. It feels like we were in this one together, and now I have to finish it alone and take all the glory. That is, if there is glory. I've almost forgotten that things can go wrong and be difficult. Exhibit A for that was Edgar Street. Exhibit B, the Rose Boys. Now I wonder what I'll deliver this time round as I walk through the door of Meluso's restaurant into the all-consuming smell and warmth of spaghetti sauce, pasta, and garlic. I've kept my eyes open for anyone following me, but I haven't seen a soul who looks interested. There are just people going about what they always do. Talking, barking crooked, swearing, telling their kids to hurry up and stop fighting, all that kind of thing. Now, in the restaurant, I ask the plump waitress to put me in the darkest corner.
Over there?
She asks in amazement.
Near the kitchen?
Yes, please.
No one's ever asked to be seated there,
she claims.
You sure, mate?
Positive.
What a strange fellow, I see her think, but she takes me over. Wine list?
Sorry?
Would you like some wine?
No, thanks. She lashes the wine list from the table and tells me the specials. I order spaghetti and meatballs and lasagna.
You expecting someone?
I shake my head.
No. So you're going to eat both?
Oh, no, I answer. The lasagna's for my dog. I promised to bring him home something. This time she gives me a look that says, what a poor, pathetic, lonely bastard. Which is understandable, I suppose. But she says, I'll bring you that just before you go, okay? Thanks.
Any drinks?
No, thanks. I refuse all drinks at restaurants because I figure I can buy a drink anywhere. It's the food I can't cook that I'm here for. She leaves and I survey the restaurant, which is half full. There are people gorging themselves, others sipping wine, while a young couple kiss over the table and share their food. The only person of interest is a man on the same side of the restaurant as me. He's waiting for someone, drinking wine but not eating. He wears a suit and has wavy comb-back hair, black and silver. Soon after I get the meatballs and spaghetti, the night's significance comes to fruition. I nearly choke on my fork when the man's guest arrives. He stands up and kisses her and puts his hands on her hips. The woman is Beverly Ann Kennedy. Bev Kennedy, otherwise known as Ma. Oh, bloody hell, I think, and I keep my head down. For some reason, I feel like I'm going to throw up. My mother's wearing a flattering dress. It's a shiny dark blue, almost the color of a storm. She sits down politely, and her hair actually flanks her face very nicely. In short, it's the first time she's ever looked like a woman to me. Usually she just looks like foul-mouthed Ma, who swears at me and calls me useless. Tonight, though, she wears earrings, and her dark face and brown eyes smile. She wrinkles a bit when she smiles, but yes, she looks happy. She looks happy being a woman. The man is very much the gentleman, pouring her some wine and asking what she'd like to eat. They talk with pleasure and ease, but I can't hear what they say. To be honest, I try not to. I think of my father. I think of him, and immediately it depresses me. Don't ask me why, but I feel like he deserved more than this. He was, of course, a drunk, especially at the end of his life, but he was so kind and generous. And gentle. Looking into my meatballs, I see his short black hair and his nearly colorless eyes. He was quite tall, and when he left for work, he always wore a flannel shirt and had a cigarette in his mouth. At home, he never smoked. Not in the house. He, too, was a gentleman, despite everything else. I also remember him staggering through the front door and lurching for the couch after closing at the pub. Ma screamed at him, of course, but it lost effect. She nagged him all the time, anyway. He'd work his guts out, but it was never enough. Remember the coffee table incident? Well, my father had to put up with that every day. When we were younger, he used to take us kids places, like the national park and the beach and a playground miles away that had a huge metal rocket ship. Not like the plastic vomit playgrounds the poor kids have to play on these days. He'd take us to those places and quietly watch us play. We'd look back and he'd be sitting there, happily smoking, maybe dreaming. My first memory is of being 4 years old and getting a piggyback from Gregor Kennedy, my father. That was when the world wasn't so big and I could see everywhere. It was when my father was a hero and not a human. Now I sit here, asking myself what I have to do next. My first order of business is to not finish the meatballs. I only watch Ma on her wonderful date. It's quite obvious that the two of them have been here before. The waitress knows them and stops for a brief exchange of words. They're very comfortable. I try not to be bitter about it and angry, but I catch myself. What's the point? She is, after all, a person, and she deserves the right to be happy just like everyone else. It's only soon after that I understand exactly why my first instinct is to begrudge her this happiness. It's nothing to do with my father. It's me. In a sudden wave of nausea, I see the absolute horror, if you will, of this situation. There's my Ma, 50 years old, hightailing around town with some guy, while I sit here, in the prime of my youth, completely and utterly alone. I shake my head. At myself. Ten of Spades. Front Porch Cyclone. The waitress takes away my meatballs and brings out the doorman's lasagna in a cheap plastic box. He'll be very happy with that, I expect. As I slip to the counter and pay, I look back at Ma and the man, cautious not to be seen, but she's totally engrossed in him. She stares and listens with such intent that I don't even bother trying to hide myself from view anymore.
I pay up and get out of there. Except I don't go home. I walk to Ma's place and wait on the front porch. It smells like my childhood, this house. I can even smell it from under the door as I sit here on the cool cement. The night is alive with stars, and when I lie down and look up, I get lost up there. I feel like I'm falling, but upward, into the abyss of sky above me. The next thing I feel is someone's foot nudging my leg. I wake up and find the face that belongs to it. "What are you doing here?" she says. That's Ma, friendly as ever. I rise to an elbow and decide not to dance around this. I came to ask you if you had a nice time at Meluso's. An expression of surprise falls from her face, though she's trying to keep it. It breaks off and she seems to catch it and fidget with it in her hands. It was very nice, she says, but I can tell she's stalling to go through her options. A woman has to live. I sit up now. I guess that's fair. She shrugs.
That the only reason you're here? To grill me about going out to dinner with a man? I have needs, you know.
Needs? Have a listen to her. She steps past me toward the door and inserts the key.
Now, if you don't mind, Ed, I'm very tired.
Now. The moment. I nearly give in, but tonight I stand up. I know full well that out of all of her offspring, I'm the only one this woman won't invite into the house in this situation. If my sisters were here, she'd already be making coffee. If it was Tommy, she'd be asking him how university's treating him, offering him a Coke or a piece of cake. Yet, with me, Ed Kennedy, every bit as much one of her kids as the others, she steps past and refuses friendliness, let alone an invitation to come in. Just once, I'd like her to be even the slightest bit affable. The door's nearly shut when I stop it with my hand. The sound of a slapped face. Her expression swells as I look at her. I speak, saying the words hard. Ma, I ask.
What?
Why do you hate me so much? And now she looks at me, this woman, as I make sure my eyes don't give me away. Flatly, simply, she answers.
Because, Ed, you remind me of him.
Him? It registers. Him. My father. She goes inside and the door slams. I've had to take a man up to the cathedral and attempt to kill him. I've had hitmen eat pies in my kitchen and lay me out. I've been jumped by a group of teenage thugs. This, however, feels like my darkest hour. Standing, hurting, on my mother's front porch. The sky opens now, crumbling apart. I want to hammer the door with my hands and my feet. I don't. All I do is sink to my knees, felled by the words that could deliver such a knockout blow. I try to make something good of it because I loved my father. Apart from the alcoholic section, I think it can't be totally shameful to be like him. So why does this feel so awful? I don't move. In fact, I vow not to leave this shitty front porch until I get the answers I deserve. I'll sleep here if I have to and wait in the scorching heat all day tomorrow. I stand back up and call out. I'm not leaving, Ma! Again. You hear me? I'm not leaving! After 15 minutes, the door pulls open again, but I don't look at her. I turn around and speak to the road, saying, you treat everyone else so good. Lee, Kath, and Tommy. It's like, I can't allow myself to weaken. I pace. But you speak to me with complete disrespect, and I'm the one who's here. Now I turn and look at her. I'm the one who's here if you need something. And each time, I do it, don't I? She agrees.
Yes, Ed.
But she also pounces. She assaults me with her own version of the truth. The words cut me through the ears so hard that I expect blood to ooze from them.
Yes, you're here,
and that's exactly it. She holds her arms out. Look at this dump. The house, the town, everything.
The voice is dark. And your father? He promised me that one day we'd leave this place. He said we'd just pack up and go. And look where we are, Ed. We're still here.
I'm here, you're here, and just like your old man, you're all promise, Ed, and no results. You, she points at me with venom. You could be as good as any of them, as good as Tommy even. But you're still here, and you'll still be here in 50 years. She sounds so cold. And you'll have achieved nothing. Fade to silence. I just want you, she breaks it, to make something of yourself. Slowly she makes her way to the front steps and says, You have to realize something, Ed. What? Carefully now, her statement comes out. Believe it or not, it takes a lot of love to hate you like this. I try to understand. She's still on the porch when I go down to the front lawn and turn back. God, it's dark now. As dark as the Ace of Spades. Were you seeing that man when Dad was still alive? I ask her. She looks at me, wishing she didn't have to. And although she says nothing, I know. I know it's not only my father she hates, but herself. That's when I realize she's got it wrong. It's not the place, I think. It's the people. We'd have all been the same anywhere else. I speak again. One last question. Did Dad know? Long pause. A pause that murders, until my mother turns away and cries, and the night is so deep and dark that I wonder if the sun will ever come up. Jack of Spades. A phone call. Ma? Yeah? I look down at the doorman, who's eating his lasagna with what can only be described as the ultimate ecstasy. It's 2:03 a.m., and I hold the phone receiver against my ear. You okay, Ma? The voice shivers back, but answers the way I expected. Yeah, I'm okay. That's good. Except you woke me, you useless. I hang up, but smile. I'd wanted to tell her I still love her, but maybe it's better this way. Queen of Spades, the Bell Street Theatre. I can't help thinking about all the things Ma said last night. It's Sunday morning, and I've hardly slept. The doorman and I each have a few coffees, but it doesn't wake me up much. I wonder if I'm done with Clown Street and my mother. But my feeling tells me I am. She needed to tell me those things. Of course, the fact that my mother thinks I'm a complete loser is not pleasant. The fact that she also considers herself one isn't much comfort either, even if it should be. In a way, it has woken me a little. I realize I can't be a cab driver all my life. It'll drive me crazy. For the first time, a message has touched part of my own life in some way. Who was it for? For Ma or me? Then I hear her words again. It takes a lot of love to hate you like this. I think I saw some relief cross her face when she told me that. The message was hers. The doorman and I go to the church to see Father O'Reilly, and he still has a fairly generous congregation. Ed, he says excitedly afterward, I was worried you weren't coming back. I've missed you the last few weeks. He pats the doorman. I guess we've been busy, I say. The Lord been with you? Not really, I answer. I think of last night and the idea of my mother committing adultery, hating my father for broken promises, and despising her only child who remains in town. Ah, he affirms. Everything has its purpose. I can only agree with that. Nothing has happened without reason, and I focus on the next message. There's only Bell Street now. And I go there in the afternoon. Number 39 is an old jaded cinema that you walk down into. There's an old terrace house above it, where a board sits glued to the awning. Today, the lettering says, Casablanca, 2:30 p.m., and Some Like It Hot, 7 p.m. As you walk down, there are posters of old movies displayed in the window. The paper is yellow on the edges, and when I walk in, there are more inside. The smell is of stale popcorn. It seems empty. Hello? I call. Nothing. This place must have died years ago when the new Greater Union multiplex was put up across town. It's deserted. Hello? I call again, louder this time. I look into a back room and see an old man sleeping. He wears a suit and bow tie, like an old-style usher. You all right, mate? I ask, and he jolts awake. Ah! He leaps from his chair and straightens up his jacket. What can I do for you? I look at the board above the counter and say, can I get a ticket to Casablanca, please?
God, you're my first customer in weeks!
The lines around the man's eyes are enormous, and he has tremendously bushy eyebrows. His white hair is combed to perfection, and although he's balding, he doesn't execute a comb-over. His expression is genuine. The man's delighted. Quite frankly, he's chuffed to bits. I hand him $10 and he gives me 5 change.
Popcorn?
Yes, please. He thrills himself as he scoops it up and puts it in the box.
On the house,
he says, and winks at me. Cheers. The cinema itself is small, but the screen is massive. I have to wait a while, but the old man comes in at about 2:25.
I don't think anyone else is coming. Would you mind if we started early?
He's probably scared I'll piss off on him if I have to wait too long. No worries. He rushes back up the aisle. I'm sitting almost exactly in the middle of the theater. If anything, I'm a row closer than further back. The movie begins. Black and white. A while through it, it cuts out and I look back up to where the projection window is. He's forgotten to change the reel. I call up. Hey! Nothing. I think he's asleep again, so I walk out and find a door that says staff only and go in. It leads to the projection room, where the man snores quietly, leaning back in his chair and against the wall at his side. Sir? I ask.
Oh, no!
He shouts at himself.
Not again!
He's visibly upset, rushing around to get the new reel, castigating himself and apologizing. It's okay, I tell him. Calm down. But he won't have any of it. He tells me over and over again.
Don't worry, son. You'll have your money back and I'll even give you a showing for free. Your choice.
He continues on fervently.
Any movie you want.
I accept. I have no other option. He rushes forward and says,
now, if you hurry down, you'll be there in time not to miss anything.
Before I head back to the theater, I feel compelled to introduce myself. I say, my name's Ed Kennedy, and hold out my hand. He stops and shakes it, looking into my face.
Yes, I know who you are.
Momentarily, he forgets about the reel and looks me directly in the eye with total friendliness.
I was told you were coming.
He carries on with his work again now. I stand there. This keeps getting better and better. I watch the rest of the movie and tell myself, I'm not walking out of here until I find out who informed the old man I'd be coming.
Enjoy that?
He asks as I come out. But I don't allow him any room for that kind of discussion. I say, who told you I was coming? He tries to shrug away.
No.
He's almost panicking.
I can't.
He's moving off now. I promised them and they were such nice fellows. I pull him back now to face me.
Who?
He appears even older now, inspecting his shoes and the carpet. Was it two men? I ask. He looks at me like yes. Daryl and Keith?
Who?
I try another angle. Did they eat your popcorn? Again a yes. It was Daryl and Keith, I confirm. The greedy bastards. They didn't hurt you, did they?
Oh, no. No, they were very nice. Genial. They came in about a month ago and watched Mr. Roberts. Before they left, they told me a guy named Ed Kennedy would be coming and that you'd get a delivery when you finished.
And when am I finished? He holds out his hands.
They told me you'd know.
His face tilts, almost in sorrow.
Are you finished?
I shake my head. No, it doesn't feel like it. I look away and back at him. I have to do something. For you. Something good, I'd say, in your case.
Why?
I almost tell him I don't know, but I refuse to lie. Because you need it. Does he need a good turnout like Father O'Reilly? I doubt it. Not twice.
Maybe.
He comes closer.
You'll finish when you come back to see that free movie.
All right, I agree.
You can bring your girlfriend, he suggests. You got a girl, Ed?
I indulge the moment. Yes, I say. I got a girl.